You're listening to a Radio 191 FM podcast.
Looking at urban biodiversity, why it's so important. They've developed a grading scale for developers and ranking biodiversity on the developments, which is really, really exciting. We're going to get to them very shortly in our news segment, Experts for Dummies.
Hi there. Are you a dummy?
Yes.
Do you need an expert to tell you things?
Yes.
Do you need help? Okay, never mind. Sometimes Radio 1's very own breakfast host Zach Hoffman talks to experts so us dummies can learn a thing or two. Here's an expert now.
Good morning, Jacqueline, Jackie Tice. We've got Jackie Tice in the studio. How are you doing?
Morning. Good. Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to be here today.
I'm very, very happy to have you, man. This is super, super awesome. I've been an admirer of ecology and biodiversity for some time, so it's cool to talk about someone who works in those fields. Before we get talking about that, though, when I Googled your name, another Jackie came up, a neuro-optometrist.
Yeah, have you been confused? I noticed that.
Have you been confused with her before?
No, not yet. She's quite successful by the looks of it, so it will be a wee while yet.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say you're quite successful as well.
Oh, thank you.
The wind, obviously, yesterday was a bit scary. How did you cope? You all good?
Yeah, all good. We had a couple of trees pretty much split in half, blocking the driveway. Mm-hmm. But all good so far, yeah.
Nice.
Obviously, it was quite a massive storm, so a few people were more affected mm-hmm. than others.
Yeah, the West Coast took a real battering. A bit scary. I hope they're doing okay. But aside from that kind of sad news, there are some pretty exciting news. I think in a few different publications, there were headlines about a weka family being spotted in Otepoti quite recently in mid-September. What have you heard about there being a potential colony in Dunedin? Do you believe the hype?
Oh, it's super exciting because, I mean, who doesn't love weka, right? Mm-hmm. They're so cheeky and charismatic native birds. But I know as much as you do. I'm not a bird specialist. All I know is that they have been sighted more than once. Mm-hmm. And I think there were some possibly even last year. So they're obviously thriving and really liking it in Dunedin. So fingers crossed for more wreckers coming our way. But I don't think there's a proper colony there as much as I'm concerned. Mm. But we have seen more, you know, charismatic native species like a kaka in the city centre just recently as well. That was around the middle of the year. So let's hope we can attract more native birds into Otepoti.
Mm-hmm. For sure, man. Before we get talking about sort of too much of the in the weeds kind of subject about urban biodiversity, I want to know kind of quickly, what are the kind of hot spots and cold spots for urban biodiversity around the country? You know, where's doing really well and where could be improved?
Yeah, so very broadly speaking, you know, the study of urban ecology is really young in New Zealand. And I mentioned that because we're not quite there yet that we have hot spots in the country for urban biodiversity.
Okay.
So we have a lot of really awesome urban biodiversity projects. George Street, which I'm sure we chat about soon, is one of the really awesome examples. Then in Wellington, they have been really proactive for predator trapping. In urban areas, which has boosted biodiversity. In Hamilton, there is heaps of restoration practice going on around the city. So there are heaps of really cool projects, but we can definitely learn from overseas examples like Melbourne, where biodiversity is really huge in urban centres around Australia in general. And I think we have a wee while to go yet to really create these hotspots of urban biodiversity in Aotearoa.
Fair enough. Speaking of Melbourne, I was there in February and I was in a friend's flat, which is in kind of one of the outlying suburbs, but still in the city. And there was just a possum fosking around up a tree. It was making heaps of noise. It was really refreshing because I was like, didn't see a lot of greenery while I was there. So that was cool to know that biodiversity there is doing well.
Yeah. And obviously they're a protected species over there, so they're really pleased to see them around.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. In the long-term goals section of Te Mana o Te Taiao Aotearoa New Zealand Biodiversity Strategy 2020 from the Department of Conservation, their 2025 goal is that indigenous vegetation planting is standard practice in urban areas, riparian zones, so on and so forth. Transport corridors as well. Would you say that this is the case or we're getting to that sort of goal?
I think there has been a mind shift, so I think we're getting there, but unfortunately it's definitely not the case. We still have a lot to do for that to be the case. So at the moment in urban areas, for example, I really focus on residential design for biodiversity and more standalone homes at the moment with private gardens are replaced by medium density housing. And that is to make room for that pressing housing demand. And what I found consistently is that these new subdivisions that are being built, they're dominated by grey, impermeable surfaces with very little vegetation, and the vegetation that is installed really lacks in species assemblage and structure. So we don't have a lot of native vegetation, mostly lawns. So there's lots we need to improve on. But generally speaking, I think it's fair to say that different councils do try to incorporate more, for example, native planting along streets. So there has been a shift in mindset, but I don't think we will get that goal for 2025. There's still work to do. Yeah.
Same with smoke-free 2025. It seems like it's a little bit still out the way there.
Yeah.
You mentioned before about the data in Aotearoa around urban biodiversity. The one thing that immediately came to my mind when I was thinking about this is that Ministry of Environment or Department of Conservation survey, which happens every year or so, and they ask the public to go outside and count birds and other critters in this area. How reliable is that data?
Yeah, so for example, the Garden Bird Survey. So obviously it's the general public that collects the data, right? So it may not always be super reliable, but what is reliable for, especially for us researchers, is the general patterns we see. So if you have thousands of logs of observations at that time during the year, we can look at patterns over the years, what can be seen. Maybe bird abundance drops or increases, or maybe there are differences between bird abundances in urban versus rural areas. And that's the data we can use and combine with more professional surveys to make it more reliable. So it's definitely reliable and really worthwhile getting out there and join as citizen scientists. And if you're really keen on it on a day-to-day basis, it's always good to use iNaturalist. So iNaturalist is an app where you can snap a picture of whatever you see in nature, be it a plant or a bug or a bird. You upload the picture to the naturalist community and they comment on species identification. And then eventually it will become research grade and researchers can use it as well for their studies,
wow,
which is awesome.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So you don't have to wait for next year to join in. But keep an eye out because myself and a couple of other students, Tabitha from Sustainability and Connell from Zoology, we are organizing a couple of BioBlitzes next year. So, yeah, keep tuned.
Cool. It kind of reminds me of some Facebook groups I'm in where people upload different photos of like native fungi or birds or insect species and ask, what is this? It's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And it seems like the kind of citizen scientist community is quite passionate about these things as well.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. You've created the New Zealand Biodiversity Factor, which provides tools and guidelines for city planners and developers to increase their project's biodiversity scores. So we see more green, which helps crucial things like pollination and clean air in our cities. Now, projects are judged by the amount of green space they have, street features, and the sort of range of indigenous / exotic vegetation of various heights. How do you arrive at these three criteria for judging urban biodiversity?
Yeah, so it was quite a lengthy process. So overall, the NZBF is basically a suite of tools that assess the biodiversity value of different urban types of developments, so residential, commercial and services, transport, and individual buildings. So the categories per tool are always slightly different, but if we focus on the residential one, where we do have these three categories that you mentioned, so permeable area, percentage, street features, and vegetation. What I did was I did really extensive literature review to look into what's important for urban biodiversity and what threatens urban biodiversity. I had really extensive knowledge exchange with experts in different fields like soil microbial diversity or artificial light at night. I had to look at satellite images and development plans to see what is consistently there in urban areas. So there's always some kind of public and private green space, streets, car parks, and obviously buildings. And that's how I slowly came up with these categories, because the more characteristics I had, the more easily they fell into these categories. And in the end, I also had to look at already existing tools that assess sustainability values, like green factor tools that are used overseas. And that way I could kind of tailor the point system a little bit. So it was quite a lengthy process, took about 2 years, but we're there, so yeah. Mm.
So using that framework, how would you score the George Street upgrade?
So George Street has done really well, especially the vegetation category, you know, which is deemed the most important because that indicates how good of habitat quality there is for native wildlife. They have done a fantastic job. They actually planted close to 3,000 plants of 60 different species, and most of these are native. Mm. And it's really important to always plant native species because our native wildlife has co-evolved with the native plants. So it's really important to predominantly plant native plants. And on George Street, I have so far found lots of cool insects. So I actually look at the colonization rates of insects of these streetside planters and look how the communities differ between George Street and more naturalized areas. And I do find a lot of orders of insects, like lots of flies. There's proof of butterflies, bees, spiders. And I'm always excited about beetles because I focus on beetles. And I found a predator beetle. So that's really important because it means that that little guy has lots of food to munch in these planters. There's now a little population of them. And it has made its own way into George Street because it can't fly. It must have crawled in. So I think that's super awesome that, you know, the planters are really supporting biodiversity.
Mm. So you kind of touched on this, but I guess I'll answer in a more formal way. Insect populations have been declining for decades now. For instance, in Germany, there's been a 75% decrease in flying insect biomass since the early 90s. Many entomologists in Aotearoa are concerned about our insect populations. How does urban biodiversity support our insect populations?
Mm. Yeah, so generally speaking, I think it's fair to say that urban areas are perceived as not really viable habitat for any native species or, you know, for insects, but they're so important. And we can totally design them to boost biodiversity. And what's most important, really, is to create quality and variety. So you want to plant lots of, well, an array of different native plants. You always want to have flowering species available. You want leaf litter to decompose naturally. These are all things that can boost insect diversity. And on a global scale, 75% of insects actually exist in areas that are not protected. Mm. And that includes urban areas. So it's super important to increase urban biodiversity because then we can create what is known in ecological terms as stepping stone habitats. So, you know, cities are mostly gray, non-permeable spaces. It's hard for insects and, for example, birds to disperse across the area. And if you have these little stepping stone habitats, these little islands of vegetation of good quality, we can make sure that they can rest or even make a living there.
Mm, which is super exciting. Mm. The thing I'm worried about is that a lot of people in Aotearoa that I've noticed, myself relatively included, are a little bit bug phobic because, you know, insects aren't as quote-unquote charismatic as other native species like our birds other mammals, I guess, like cats or dogs. How do you convince the publics that more bugs in our cities is a public good? Do you think that's going to be hard?
Yeah, I think sadly what you said is true, that a lot of people don't really appreciate bugs for what they are. Mm. I'm really biased because I love bugs. And when I'm in the lab and, you know, like when I get my microscope out and I zoom in onto the bugs I find and their colors and their weapons, you know, it's just so fascinating. But obviously that's not what the general public sees. They see all these birds flying around and insects. They can be quite hard to spot. But I think we need a shift in mindset instead of thinking, oh man, these flies are really annoying because of their buzzing or the spiders are gross or I don't know. We need to think of what the insect does in the ecosystem and how it serves us maybe to some extent. You know, they decompose waste. Mm. They pollinate. Without insects, we wouldn't have food. And they serve as a food resource for our birds that we all love. Mm. You know, they're at the bottom of the food chain. And ultimately, I always think of ecosystems like these massive machines, right? And they have heaps of cables kind of plugged in to function. And each cable represents a different species or interaction between species. And the vast majority of these cables are actually insects. Of all the animal species in the world, 85% are insects. Mm-hmm. And if you start pulling these cables out, and we have seen lots of mass declines in insects, the machine, the ecosystem starts to glitch and starts to play up and go out of balance. Mm-hmm. So if we perceive insects for what they truly are and what they do, I think we can totally shift the mindset and encourage people to love bugs just a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. You might have to love the look of them, but they provide some really important services.
Absolutely,
for
yeah.
sure, for sure. And also, I will concur, I wrote a book about all different bee species around the world, and there's an incredible vast variety of colours of bees. It's nuts.
Yeah, we always think of the one honeybee, but there's many bees. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Now, returning to that DOC biodiversity strategy I mentioned earlier, their 2030 goal is for infrastructure and urban planning to include indigenous biodiversity as standard practice, including through green infrastructure, green spaces, ecological corridors, and environmentally friendly design elements. Do you think that this is a goal we can see successive governments committing to? Do you think this is something that is going to be inevitable for our urban planning in the future?
Yeah, well, I think it's absolutely necessary. You know, ultimately, it should be made mandatory further down the road to include biodiversity in urban design. We see it overseas. In the UK, they have just introduced what's called the biodiversity net gain law. So if there's a new urban development, they need to account for habitats lost. So they measure the biodiversity value before and after.
Wow.
And that's why I've created the New Zealand biodiversity factor in a way that can be applied to pre- and post-development spaces. Mm-hmm. So you can see either an increase or often sadly decrease in biodiversity value. And ultimately, if we want, you know, to have safe environments to live in, you all probably heard about the recent floods in South Dunedin, all to do with climate change, but also there's mostly non-permeable space. So really, governments have to act on that and have to change how cities are designed, and that includes the incorporation of biodiversity. And it also benefits our mental and physical well-being.
Oh, for sure.
Plenty of literature out there. And there was actually a recent survey in Australia where they found that having that connection to nature was deemed just as important as income in determining life satisfaction. And I think that's amazing. So we really need to incorporate it. So I think it will become absolutely necessary that successive governments include it.
Hopefully. I got one quick question about, I guess, density, because it seems like New Zealand and its urban centres are on a trajectory to increase its density. The Mayor of Auckland, Wayne Brown, has indicated he wants to build up Auckland. And I think that the sort of RMA, the resource management rules around building high density buildings in urban areas, are getting a bit loosened. Is it easy to incorporate urban biodiversity in more intensified urban areas?
Yes, there are definitely ways in which we can increase it. And, you know, it could be simple things like not everyone needs their own car park right in front of their door. If we group, for example, the car parks into one area of the subdivision, that automatically makes room for more green space. Or we could have permeable car parks. You know, just little things like that actually free up a lot of space for permeable space. Then there are solutions like green roofs or green vaults. And it really, we have now seen with the George Street example that the size of green space doesn't really matter. It's the quality.
Mm.
And a lot of these densely built up spaces, they do have a lot of really tiny outdoor spaces, but they can be planted in the right way to boost biodiversity. It's absolutely possible.
Right. It's better to have like a patch of effective biodiversity than just like a big lawn.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. There's tons of those in the cargo where I'm originally from, which is nice, but it is cool to have native biodiversity that is working for our pollinators and our insects. Yeah. Well, thank you for your time and coming on the program,
Jackie.
Thank you
so much for having me.
Do you have any final words for our lovely listeners?
Just get out there and enjoy nature when you're next time around George Street Planters. Make sure to sit down and appreciate for what it is, not just aesthetics, but, you know, it's boosting biodiversity. And have a rethink what you can do in your gardens or on your balconies or backyards, you know, even if you just put in like a little native shrub or a flowering plant, it really helps to boost biodiversity in cities.
For sure. Thank you very much. Folks, that was Jackie Tice. We're talking to Jackie about urban biodiversity in Otipoti. Jackie's giving a talk about this topic at Umbrellos next Tuesday at 5:30. I've got the nod from Jackie there. That is correct. If you want to go learn more about that, go on down.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.